The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. On this week's show, part of my conversation with Nishay Devineau, Ph.D., who's a postdoctoral associate at the Institute for Research in Sensing at the University of Cincinnati, where she studies bioethical perspectives on the nascent field of psychedelic medicine. Dr. Devineau is also the Medicine Society and Culture Research Fellow at Symposia. And Brian Pace, Ph.D., who's a lecturer who teaches psychedelic studies at The Ohio State University and also the Politics and Ecology Editor at Symposia.
Hello, my name's Brian Pace. I'm an affiliate scholar with the Center for Psychedelic Drug Research and Education at The Ohio State University's College of Social Work. I'm also a lecturer in the Department of Plant Pathology at OSU, where I teach a class called Psychedelic Studies. And I am the Politics and Ecology Editor for Symposia, which is a 501c3 nonprofit research organization, media outlet, and watchdog in the drug policy and culture arena.
And I'm Nishay Devineau. I'm a postdoctoral associate at the Institute for Research in Sensing at the University of Cincinnati. I'm also an affiliate scholar with the Center for Psychedelic Drug Research and Education at The Ohio State University, and I'm the Medicine Society and Culture Fellow with Symposia. So I got involved in the field back in 2010. I was already privately interested in psychedelics on my own, just not openly about it. And I went to graduate school studying literature because I was trying to kind of think about the wild sorts of experiences that came up in psychedelic experiences and how to think about them as stories, but, you know, hadn't really been open about that. And I went to my first psychedelics conference in 2010. And just had this really mind-opening experience in the sense that I found out for the first time then that there was this whole psychedelic science renaissance happening in sciences with psychology and clinical research happening at universities. And in that moment, I realized that it would be a great opportunity to, you know, bring all the other disciplines in it as well, because science doesn't have any kind of monopoly over psychedelic experience. And so from that time forward, I've been kind of advocating for other, you know, especially I have a humanities background, so more disciplines to get involved. And Brian and I just wrapped up the Psychedemia Psychedelics Conference at The Ohio State University, which was intended to do exactly that, bringing all these disciplines together. We did it for the first time in 2012, and this is the kind of the follow-up conference. But I've been teaching psychedelic studies classes since about 2011, and Brian also teaches at OSU.
Yeah, and just briefly, you know, my training is as a plant evolutionary ecologist, and I've spent a lot of time thinking about things like food, ethnobotany, climate change. I spent a lot of time doing field work in southern Mexico and such. And, you know, I started teaching classes about cannabis and then moved along into psychedelic studies, as these were sort of long part of my personal interest and one of the reasons why I was studying mycology and plant chemistry and ethnobotany in the first place. So now I teach this class, and Dr. Devineau's work on this is one of the first essays that my students read.
Dr. Devineau, you mentioned that you, when you were first getting into this, you went to an early psychedelics conference and kind of sort of a mind expanding experience, which is kind of poetic, I suppose. Of course, not all these conferences are mind expanding. There was this conference recently, a convention down in Florida, which I heard about through Twitter. It's called Wonderland. I didn't go. I don't really do corporate events. You know, I caught a couple of the weed business conferences here in Oregon several years ago, back when the industry was just starting out. I was mostly just to meet up with old friends and to get a couple of interviews, of course, get some good audio. But business conferences are just not my bag, you know. I'm not into stock valuations and buyouts and reverse mergers and making a greasy buck off of other people's sweat. And that brings us back to this Florida event, Wonderland. What was Wonderland? And more importantly,
well,
and before you start, more importantly, what was Wonder Band?
Yeah. Okay. So these are two related things, and I'll be honest, I would not have really been able to give you a good picture of what Wonderland was until Dr. Devineaux and myself, as well as several other individuals, were Wonder Band. So, what, Thursday of last week, at the time of recording here, we midday were texted, and sort of almost simultaneously, it broke from an anonymous account called Head Twitch Memes, that there was a document floating around a conference, which is the most well-funded, psychedelics conference that we're aware of. That's, I think, in its second iteration in Miami, Florida, called Wonderland, organized by a group called Microdose HQ is their Twitter handle. I think they're like Microdose. They have a longer name for their actual business. In any case, they had a run of show document, which anybody who's running a conference, as we recently did ourselves, would have, that says, where everybody needs to be and what needs to happen. And on this document, clearly labeled run of show, was a little shy of a dozen people's pictures, including everyone's photo who is on the symposia website. That would include Dr. Devineaux and I. And it simply said, banned from all events, no, absolutely no entry under no circumstances. And so, on that list were, collectively, academics and journalists, fellow psychedelics conference organizers like ourselves, harm reduction activists, and curiously, two of the former business partners of the backers of this conference. So kind of a motley crew. And this sort of comes across our desks while we're all like, frankly, minding our own business. And so we very quickly had to figure out what in the heck was going on down in Florida.
Well, and we'd already
Yeah.
heard about our so another non-Symposia journalist who was visiting the conference in person, Sasha Sisko, and they were, we had heard previously, escorted out by the police when they tried to come into the conference, and they didn't ex they no one explained to them why. They were, it was under some kind of, they attributed it to coming in with a kind of false name or credentials or something, but they didn't explain that there was a ban list. And then the ban list appeared, and the fact that someone had already been escorted out by police lent some credibility. And then there was confirmation around the fact that this ban list was legitimate. And actually, over just this past weekend, so on Saturday, the organization that ran the conference released a statement that reiterated something that we had heard from a few people before that, but was not confirmed by the organization, that we were banned because we had had threatened in some way the physical safety of the speakers at the conference, which was completely untrue.
We had heard about this as a rumor, and it was a rumor that was confirmed as being heard by n no less than Rick Doblin himself, that there were threats, or that the organizers, or that someone affiliated with the conference, we believe, was sharing information, saying that the people on the ban list had all, and we're talking about almost a dozen people here, had all made threats against the safety of other conference speakers. We didn't have a whole lot of information, so this was sort of hearsay, but we do know that this was what was circulating, and that Rick Doblin didn't believe it to be credible himself. He's Nishay, Dr. Devineaux, and I were both at a conference in Toronto where Rick Doblin was in the room, and there's obviously, it's preposterous, it's outrageous that these kinds of things are circulating. And these were rumors that we heard and confirmed to be circulating around, but the public statement that has been made, which we won't get too much into, seems to you know, convey similar sentiment. You know, the people who were banned because, you know, that the physical safety of, you know, of people who were attending was of paramount concern. You know, in terms of safety and security, physical safety were being, you know, conflated with speech online, you know, public debate, scholarship, journalism.
It's clearly not a good look, right? You know, for this, you know, industry conference to be portraying a group of, you know, academics, critical journalists in this way. Like, a lot of people looking in on this kind of see clearly that this is a tactic and what's going on here. We've all gotten a huge amount of new Twitter followers as people have kind of, you know, looked to the ban list as a who to follow list, you know, in that sense. So there's been, I guess, a silver lining, but it also speaks to the lengths to which people in industry are willing to go, you know, to kind of advance their own narrative around psychedelics.
Which would be like really a case study in corporadelics. Like, if we think that these kinds of tactics are you know, good, well, the individuals who would very much like to corner this market, you know, well, they certainly do. Now, if that wasn't weird enough, and I did use the word outrageous, it gets worse, because while all this was going on, no less than former TV celebrity turned corporate chemist Hamilton Morris of Hamilton's Pharmacopeia from Vice took to the stage as a keynote speaker, mind you, and used his platform to attack other journalists, some from Vice, one in particular from Vice, Shayla Love, who does great work and has interviewed Nishay and I, Dr. Devineau and I, and the talk proceeded to Hamilton calling out our work in particular, right-wing psychedelia, which he referred to as absurd, directly after talking about an article in The Guardian that discussed it, which he called insane. So here we have this scenario where, you know, we've been banned from a conference without our knowledge, and then, you know, a celebrity goes on stage and begins mocking and misrepresenting our peer-reviewed literature. It's absolutely bonkers.
You know, I mentioned I'm old. I remember years ago, back, oh my goodness, normal conferences of days gone by. Back in the 90s, there was a lot of controversy over the direction Normal was taking, and a couple of dissidents got elected to Normal's board. And I remember sitting in on that board meeting as a non-member, just an observer, because I'm a friend of folks. And a couple of them got into such a, I mean, they're shouting each other, so angry, so close. I swear, I thought they were going to bite each other's faces off. It was just weird and interesting. In another Normal conference, Ed Rosenthal was up making a pitch, and they're fundraising for this and that, and got a little heated, and Keith tried to pull him from the microphone, and that didn't go well, and ended up with Keith Strop and Ed Rosenthal scuffling in the middle of the venue.
Sure.
And spilling out into the hallway. One of their jackets got torn. And we, you know,
which
we
is certainly something that's going on in Wonderland's fever dreams, but like, we don't behave like that. That's ridiculous.
Well, the rest of the point is we didn't ban Ed. He spoke that weekend, and you know, and he continues to. You have people who are. I mean, well, normal. We used to have DEA agents come to the Normal conference, and not in that kind of. Oh, I bet he's a DEA agent. They registered. Where are they from? Drug Enforcement Agency. Oh, okay. Or Drug Enforcement Administration. Oh, okay. You know, I mean, big tent. There's an old political thing about the big tent where you want to have people on the inside, because when they're on the inside, you just don't. I mean, there's ways of doing things. Oh, Jesus Christ. Pardon me. I understand that it really happened. It's just, what were these people? What the hell were these people on? Good grief.
I mean, we have a few ideas as to how such a scenario, you know, came to be, at least aspects of it. But I do, you know, as you said, you know, at normal conferences, you used to have DEA agents speak. But in this case, you know, the police were called to remove an individual who had a ticket, you know, from their illegal drugs conference. Like, it's a little ironic, but with regard to, you know, at least one aspect of this, like I mentioned earlier that, you know, Hamilton Morris, most people know him from his documentary series, Hamilton's Pharmacopoeia. But, you know, in very recently, Hamilton has taken a job as a like a chemical consultant for Compass Pathways. It really may be that there are other aspects of Hamilton's agreement and job description and responsibilities for Compass Pathways that he's enacting. Compass Pathways is an organization that Symposia has reported on, the work of managing editor David Nichols, staff writer Russell Hausfeld, is an excellent place for anyone to start to understand the corporadelic dynamics of at least one organization that is leading the charge to psychedelic monopoly. So, you know, Hamilton Morris, when he speaks publicly about psychedelics, is doing so as, at least in part, a public relations representative of a company that would very much like to corner the market on psilocybin therapy. They own hundreds of patents on psilocybin combinations, like psilocybin therapy for pyromania, psilocybin therapy for restless leg syndrome, psilocybin therapy for oppositional defiant disorder. Those are real patents that they have. And, you know, Hamilton going out and denouncing not just us, but the work of Shayla Love, you know, people, voices, scholars and journalists who are troubling psychedelic capitalism. He's doing a solid to his employer when he does that.
This is part of my conversation with Dr. Neshe Deveneau and Dr. Brian Pace, affiliate scholars at the Center for Psychedelic Drug Research and Education at The Ohio State University College of Social Work.
Drug war! No more!
Drug war!
No more!
Drug war!
You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. The Europeans came over here to Abya Yala and they discovered all this amazing land and discovered all these amazing things. And the English came over here and discovered tobacco. So, I mean, to what extent is the sort of corporadelic, the sort of corporate takeover of what am I trying to ask? Are there any similarities in that kind of the in terms of corporadelic and the,
sure.
the corporate incursion into psychedelics?
Yeah.
Are there similarities with colonization generally, the kind of colonization
yeah.
that brought us here?
Yeah. So, I mean, I would say, you know, that's actually a great frame to think about this. I have often talked about how, you know, the enclosure movements that were in the, you know, part of the prefiguration of capitalism in Europe, where the common lands to harvest timber and to hunt, you know, suddenly these became the king's forest in which people harvesting and gathering became poachers. So an enclosure is a seizing of the commons and taking, you know, taking it for one's exclusive right. We're seeing a similar thing with patents, you know, simply by saying that, you know, you've thought of a novel combination of use for psilocybin, then you now have the exclusive right to profit from it. The idea of colonization is it's an you know, it's an ongoing process. We have this situation with psychedelics where they seem like new medicines, or even if they are new medicines, we really only map back to what, the 60s or something. But all of these were actively suppressed by colonizers, whether you're talking about the friars or the later churches that, you know, developed afterwards, that all of them had some interest in repressing indigenous sacraments. Nisha, do you want to jump in here at all?
Yeah, and I'll just add that one of the ideas that we looked at in Dark Side of the Shroom develops from the late theorist at Mark Fisher's work. So Fisher talked about this idea called capitalist realism, which is this idea that, you know, it's easier to imagine the end of the world than it is to imagine the end of capitalism. Like, capitalism is so baked into the way that we, in the society, you know, especially, like, conceive of the possibilities for how society is structured. And so one of the things that, I mean, I'm most interested in with psychedelics is this possibility of using psychedelic experience to kind of get outside of your normal experience of reality so that you can kind of think creatively and differently about how the world could be organized. And so there is this potential to use psychedelics in a way that is, you know, pro-social and towards kind of gaining creativity around organizing the world to be fairer and more just and equitable for the average person. But if we are kind of only going to have psychedelics in these corporate clinics where you have co-therapist teams that are trained to redirect your experiences towards individualized issues and solutions, then it kind of undercuts the potential to use them in these more broader world building senses. So it's a, you know, the fact that psychedelics can be used beyond capitalism should be a reason to kind of resist the kind of turning this over to a force that is clearly wreaked a lot of harm in the world that we're currently living in.
Yeah, it reminds me of David Wingrow and David Graeber's The Dawn of Everything, one of the three fundamental freedoms that they talked about, one of which they said has seemed to evaporate these days, which is the freedom to reorganize social relations. And combined with Mark Fisher's thought that it's today even difficult to imagine a different set of organizations, I think that some of what Dr. Deveneau is talking about is incredibly relevant, but it's context specific, you know. So the kinds of festivals, the kinds of hikes in the woods, you know, the people who are in psychedelic research and some, in case not all, in psychedelic investment, this is fundamentally and categorically different than what's being proposed for the masses, which is this kind of controlled experience that that Dr. Deveneau is referring to.
The old saying, right, if you can't beat them, join them. Or in this case, if you can't eliminate them, then co-opt them. Well, reimagining the way that the world is presented to you and trying to find another way, the kinds of things you can do with psychedelics, it's a great thing unless you are heavily invested in keeping things just the way they bloody are, in which case you figure out you either get rid of them, like the church tried, or you try to co-opt them, like the corporations are trying. Fascinating. Scary. This is a good time to ask about Power Trip. Tell me about Power Trip.
Yeah, so our colleagues at Symposia, Lily K. Ross and David Nichols, were producers of that along with New York Magazine. And it was a really significant kind of investigative reporting into legacies of abuses in psychedelics, beginning with kind of the underground research, or underground therapy rather, and then moving into the clinical research with MAPS and, you know, abuses that had taken place in clinical trials but weren't widely known about or acknowledged, and certainly not dealt with adequately, or you know, there wasn't sufficient follow-up. And so at Symposia, like a lot of people who saw the ban list around Wonderland kind of thought it was normal for Symposia to be excommunicated in that way because of projects like Power Trip. I mean, to me, it reminds me of, like, there are cases with cults or kind of enclosed religious communities that shun people who speak up about abuses to the outside world. You know, it's like they view them as, like, things that should be dealt with internally, and you shouldn't be going to the, you know, the courts or the police, you know. To there's a similar dynamic going on here, I think, in the sense that people, by naming these problems in the clinical context, Lily and Dave especially, have been ostracized by a lot of members of the community. But it's an extremely important podcast to listen to.
Thank you. Yes, because that's one of the there are so many podcasts out there and so many people talking about a lot of this, and unfortunately the money pushes a lot of the corporate sort of PR stuff to the top. And what you're talking about with Power Trip and some of the, I mean, there is potential for abuse. Any kind of therapeutic relationship, there's potential. And when you're talking about drug experiences, I've been following some of the happenings up in Canada with those clinical trials, and it's concerning, to say the least. It's concerning. I like that you referred to excommunication. I suppose that's, I mean, when I say the church just tried to ban it, the corporations just tried to co-opt it, but even within that corporate co-option, they want to make sure that no dissenting voices get heard. And that's it's an interesting parallel.
And part of the point of Power Trip was that what happened to the people who were harmed, including Megan Buisson, whose videos were shared as an adjunct to the podcast, the videos of the clinical trials, that specific situation, like, did not need to happen. There were red flags ahead of time. There were things that should not have been done. There were also ideologies about the need to make people experience distress, or like the healing potential of distress, that together accumulated to make a situation where that was not safe for Megan. And so a lot of people do talk about, well, therapy can, you know, as always, there's always a power imbalance and there's always a risk of, you know, abusive dynamics. But there were, in this situation, there were decisions that were made that could have been made differently. And so, and that's part of the reason they did this, was to kind of shine a light on how choices could be made to create a safer, more therapeutic context for people.
That was part two of my conversation with Neshe Devineaux, PhD, who's a postdoctoral associate at the Institute for Research in Sensing at the University of Cincinnati, where she studies bioethical perspectives on the nascent field of psychedelic medicine. Dr. Devineaux is also the Medicine Society Culture Research Fellow at Symposia. And Brian Pace, PhD, who's a lecturer who teaches psychedelic studies at The Ohio State University and also the Politics and Ecology Editor at Symposia. Dr. Devineaux and Dr. Pace are also affiliate scholars at the Center for Psychedelic Drug Research and Education at The Ohio State University College of Social Work. So now, dear listener, I know what you're thinking. This was part two. What about part one? Well, fear not, friend. You did not miss an installment of Century. Part one of this interview actually airs on another radio show that I produce, which, like this one, is distributed via the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network's audio port service. That show is called Free Culture Radio. It's available now. Easiest way to find it is just Google my name and the name of the show. So it's McVeigh and Free Culture Radio. And that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy reform and the failed war on drugs.
This is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition. The Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.